Healthcare Today is produced and paid for by the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to wdev@radiovermont.com. Healthcare Today with Dr. Lewis Myers, a weekly exploration of health and wellness topics affecting Vermonters. Brought to you in part by Westview Meadows and the Gary Residence, retirement living the way it's meant to be. Age Well Vermont, the leading experts and advocates for older adults in northwestern Vermont. Northfield Pharmacy, pharmacy care with a personalized hometown touch. Northfieldpharmacy.com. And Kinney Drugs and KinneyDrugs.com, employee owned and locally committed. Your participation is encouraged. Call with your questions, 244-1777 or 877-291-8255.
And good afternoon. I'm Dr. Lewis Myers, and this is Healthcare Today. Our show today is going to be on sports medicine and orthopedic injuries, and our guests are orthopedist Dr. Matthew Gammons and physical therapist Michael D. The injuries we're going to talk about can occur at any age and at any level of participation, and our two guests are clinicians who help us get back on our feet and back in the game. Dr. Matthew Gammons is a sports medicine physician at the Vermont Orthopedic Clinic and Killington Medical Clinic. He is board certified in family and sports medicine and serves as the medical director of sports medicine and the sports concussion clinic at the Vermont Orthopedic Clinic. He is past president of the American Medical Society for sports medicine and currently serves as a team physician for U.S. Ski and Snowboard, as well as several local universities and high schools. Mr. Michael D. has been a physical therapist for many years. He was board certified. He has board certification in sports therapy. He originally went to the State University of New York at Upstate and did his sports medicine training in New York City. He has worked at the University of Vermont and has had his own private practice for many years in Chittenden County. I want to welcome you both, Dr. Gammons and Michael D.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, we're going to... I think Mr. D may have to leave a little early, so we're going to get him involved early, but we're going to go head to toe and touch on different areas. And I want to start with head injuries. We may actually have an entire show at some point on concussions, but I know that Dr. Gammons has experience in treating concussions, and I imagine Mr. D does as well. Dr. Gammons, I'll start with you. As an orthopedist, what is your approach to concussions?
Well, it's really, I'm really more of a non-operative sort of orthopedist and sports doc, so part of that encompasses sort of the medical care of athletes, including non-orthopedic injuries like head injury. And it ranges, again, you know, sports medicine physicians, because we often practice on the sideline, or in my case, on the side of the mountain sometimes, it ranges from the acute evaluation of a head injury to see if somebody has something more going on in which they might need to go to the hospital for imaging, all the way down to the follow-up of, you know, young athletes that have sustained head injuries and trying to help them recover from the injuries that they've had.
By the way, I want to I meant to add at the beginning, for those who are not in medicine, they may not be aware of this, but orthopedic residencies are some of the most sought-after residencies among medical students. So while many orthopedists are ex-athletes, ex-jocks, as it were, they also tended to be in the top of their class. So just thought I would point that out. And the same for physical therapy, which involves an incredible detailed knowledge of anatomy and physiology and the kinesiology, which is the science of movement. Often physical therapists know more about anatomy and physiology than certainly than most physicians. So with that, I want to go to Mr. D. Now, in your clinic for physical therapy, I imagine you do treat people who have had concussions.
Yes, we do. Typically, they've been cleared by a physician and referred to us for the concussive injuries. So in most settings like ours, they've had the injury, they've been followed by their physician, symptoms are starting to decline, and they're referred. And really, our job is to put them through maneuvers and aerobic activities and monitor symptoms, make sure they don't return. I cover youth football and men's indoor box lacrosse, so that's the other exposure I've had to it, where it happens on the floor of the playing field. And So you evaluate on a field and assess it and refer immediately if need be, or contact the physician and speak to the parents or the player how to manage it acutely.
What are some of the ongoing symptoms of concussions in athletes, and how do you what are some of the maneuvers that you do?
In physical therapy, light sensitivity, confusion, inability to concentrate. And so we don't really treat those. We watch that they subside as we introduce an aerobic activity. So you might start someone on a stationary bike, so there's no jumping up and down, if you will, or weight-bearing activities, and progress into more resistance training, and then maybe something on the treadmill or elliptical, then running down the treadmill, then move to agility maneuvers, all the while watching to make sure that none of these symptoms return.
I imagine it's somewhat unpredictable. In other words, people progress at different stages, rates.
Dr. Gammon, that's been my experience. But it is somewhat unpredictable. But maybe you could add to that, Dr. Gammon.
Well, sure, thank you. And yeah, Dr. Myers, it's averages, right? I mean, we always talk about averages, but there's a big bell curve. I think one of the most valuable things that physical therapists help us with, though, and I'm sure you see this, is that there's often associated injuries. So these are often kind of head and neck trauma, and the concussion may be one part of it, but they often have whiplash injuries. They may have some inner ear injuries. They may have sensitization of peripheral tissue. So there's some nerves that come out of the neck that can cause headaches. And as we learn more, you know, a lot of the things that we used to say were sort of, we've lumped sort of under concussion, really are probably more associated injuries. So you can have associated injuries that mimic concussion, and then you can have concussion along with other injuries. And you want to treat those other injuries at the same time and not just wait for some of them to respond. So, for example, physical therapists working on the neck can be very, very valuable in helping athletes return.
Yeah, I concur. We do see that in the practice. And as the three of us know, the upper part of your neck, the cervical spine, when we rotate our head side to side, about half of that takes place between the first and second vertebra. So I concur, Dr. Gammon, with these head injuries. Oftentimes you'll find that first and second level of the cervical spine is not moving, and there's some pretty simple and easy maneuvers to loosen it up and get them so they can rotate their head, and then it can travel down to the rest of the neck and shoulder.
That's a very helpful observation that it's not all in the head, that it involves other parts of the body as well, that is concussions. Let me let our viewers know, as always, if you have any questions for our guest today, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or text us at 802-585-3026. So I'm going to move away from the spine for now, but I want to talk about shoulder injuries. And in particular, I'll start with Dr. Gammon's fractured clavicle, which is the collarbone. What is your approach to a fractured collarbone?
Well, it is one of the more common fractures that we see overall, particularly in athletes. And most commonly it occurs in the middle of the clavicle. So if it occurs sort of where the clavicle attaches to the sternum, or if it occurs where the clavicle attaches out to the top of the shoulder blade, it's slightly different. But if we speak just in the middle, you know, fortunately, most of them do quite well with conservative treatment. The body's pretty amazing at its ability to sort of piece things back together. So if it's a fracture that doesn't need surgery, then it basically is a sling for comfort, and then working on early range of motion exercises, and then progressing into see a physical therapist as soon as symptoms allow. If the pieces of the clavicle are too far apart, then I'm going to refer that to one of my partners, who can then put the pieces back together with a plate to hold them while the fracture heals.
Unlike some of the injuries we'll talk about today, which tend to be both acute and also from overuse, I guess the fractured clavicle is really almost always an acute injury rather than overuse. If you don't have to operate, how long does it usually take for a fractured collarbone to heal?
Approximately 8 weeks, depending on age. I mean, certainly, you know, kids, prepubescent kids are going to heal faster. You know, as we get into sort of mid-teens and beyond, we generally have you avoid, you know, high-risk activity that would involve falling or contact for about 8 weeks. But the nice thing is, this is something where you can use and move the arm during that time frame. You don't have to stay completely immobile, but we don't want it to take a blow until the fracture is strong enough to tolerate that load.
Once it's healed, are there any lasting effects from a fractured clavicle?
In general, no. I mean, certainly there is some concern if the pieces are sort of, if the collarbone heals too short, so if the break overlaps, sometimes that can affect how the shoulder works, and there's a small percentage of people that may have an issue with that. There's occasionally, it depends on the study you look at, there's about a 1% chance of what we call non-union clavicle fractures, meaning they just don't heal. That's the bad news. The good news is those are generally fixable with surgery. So
let's talk about rotator cuff injuries and stress. Dr. Gammons, can you tell us what is the rotator cuff? What does that mean?
So the rotator cuff is really the four muscles that surround the shoulder, the kind of the ball in the socket. You got one that sits on the front, one on the top, and two on the back. And the muscle part attaches to the shoulder blade. So think of it as the stake. And then the tendons, which are the ropes, attach on to the ball, and they help not only help us move our arm, but they also kind of help keep the ball centered in the socket, because the shoulder socket really isn't a ball socket like the hip where the ball sits in. It's really more, people describe it as a golf ball on a tee, where the ball is just kind of resting on the cuff.
And when we talk about, what is your evaluation? How do you start evaluating a possible rotator cuff injury or just shoulder pain in general?
Well, I mean, exactly. You know, unfortunately, shoulder pain is relatively common, both in athletes and certainly in just active individuals. It almost always starts with what somebody's range of motion is, meaning how well do they move the arm, because that really dictates a lot of what other things could be going on. So as we start to get older, sometimes things like arthritis of the shoulder can become a cause of shoulder pain. And also sort of what sort of treatments do they need with someone like Mr. D in terms of, do they have good motion but they just have pain and they have to work on some of the balancing, or are they really restricted in motion and we need to work on that before we work on some of the strengthening and other things they need to accomplish.
On your physical exam or symptom-wise, are there any tip-offs that it might be a torn rotator cuff or either partial or complete?
Well, rotator cuff pain tends to refer sort of down the outside of the arm, so from the top of the shoulder down to about the mid-arm, so that is a clue. I always tell patients, everybody wears out the rotator cuff. So when we say that, when we talk about tearing, what we're talking about is the tendons, the ropes. And if you think about a rope that you use at home a lot, what happens? It gets frayed, it gets little tears here and there. By the time we get into our 70s, about 30% of people actually have big rotator cuff tears and don't even know it, so it's kind of that slow process. You know, anybody over the age of 35 likely has some wear, and if you pitch for the Red Sox or the Yankees, you probably have some wear in your 20s. So anybody in sort of those age ranges, you're automatically suspicious that there's probably some wear and tear as far as the cuff goes.
When do you use radiology to help you with that diagnosis?
So we commonly use x-rays, particularly in either individuals that have had previous trauma or people that are older, just to make sure we're not missing an underlying arthritis. Because certainly if you have some significant arthritis in the shoulder, then trying to move that can actually make the pain worse rather than helpful. I generally move to either ultrasound or MRI when somebody is sort of not progressing with the normal course of therapy, which oftentimes if they're not making progress with a therapeutic exercise plan over 6 weeks or so, we start to think about whether or not we should be getting some additional pictures.
So one of the first steps would be to refer someone for physical therapy rather than go to immediately to surgery.
Almost always, yes.
Mr. D, a person comes to you with a painful shoulder, possible rotator cuff strain or tear. Tell us about some of the exercises that you prescribe.
The first thing we do is rule out the cervical spine, making sure none of that pain is coming from the neck. Then it's basically what Dr. Gammon is saying. We want to look at passive and active range of motion, test their strength of the specific muscles of the shoulder and the shoulder blade, a few special tests, and now we have so much information that Dr. Gammon just alluded to with the different age groups that we can pretty much guess that there's some wear and tear and fraying. And so then we begin an exercise program. Typically you want to, if it hurts them in their shoulders, they raise their arm up to about 90 degrees. It's a good idea to start the rotator cuff exercises with the arm down at the side, and it can be elbow is bent to 90 and your arm is straight out in front of you, and let's say that's 12 o'clock. And with resistance bands, you can resist pulling towards your chest, so if you're going from 12 over to 10 o'clock, and then to resist the external rotators, you imagine the arm is straight out at 12 o'clock and you rotate out as if you're going to 2 o'clock. It's a good idea to keep the elbow against the rib and squeeze it. By squeezing it, you inhibit the large deltoid muscle. It really wants to kind of oppose one of the rotator cuff muscles, so you quiet that muscle while you're letting the injured rotator cuff work. Then you would include exercises that make sure the shoulder blade is positioned well and is moving well. And then you might find a tight muscle or two that you want to stretch. But we now know, and the Norwegians discovered this back in the 1950s, that early on you can give high, high, high repetitions, very low resistance, and you're stimulating all the cellular processes that can get the best repair that you can. And we don't always repair these things, but people get better. And so what we're now seeing is that patients will come direct to us, and they want 6 weeks of therapy before they'll even order an MRI. So we keep an eye on them during those first...
What percentage of your patients that you see end up eventually needing surgery?
A very small percentage, and there might be a lot of reasons why. In other words, we're getting the ones that have insidious pain and just something's bothering them, and it's a pretty quick and easy fix if you adhere to what's been researched and shown to work. That's in the low number because of that, and I think because people are coming to physical therapy a little earlier now. Occasionally there'll be a trauma and they'll come to see us and we know it's torn, it's going to need surgery, so we'll just give them a little pre-surgical exercise program. We don't see them much before surgery, but just give them some exercises. So a small percentage go on for surgery.
So, Dr. Gammons, once someone does go into surgery, if they have a total tear of their rotator cuff, is that repairable?
Well, most of the time, because you would hope to know going in, and usually the imaging can give you a sense of whether or not the tear is fixable. It's not always clear. But generally, we're going in to do surgery, and my partners, I should say, because I don't do the shoulder surgeries, but they go in with the anticipation that they're going to be able to fix the tear. Because, like I said, as you get older, some of these tears can be more chronic, and I use the example, my father was in his early 70s and fell a few years ago and hurt his shoulder and didn't do well in therapy, partly his fault because he didn't do the exercises, but he ended up with an MRI that showed a tear, but the tear was old. So he had been living with a tear for a lot of years, and so it wasn't something he needed surgery for, he just needed to work better at his therapy.
So once the surgery for a rotator cuff is complete, people go back to physical therapy, and I know that that's a critical part of the healing process, the post-op as well. So Mr. D, when they come back to you after surgery, are the exercise program different?
Yes. Typically the surgeon will send the guidelines of what to do in the first 2 weeks, the first 4 weeks, and so there's timelines all the way up to 16 weeks. So typically you're going to be doing passive range of motion to the shoulder in some of the basic planes that we look at, and making sure that the client understands the do's and don'ts, and that they should really respect what happened to them, because these things can fail if they are irresponsible. So there's a lot of education. And then this passive range of motion, typically for 4 to 6 weeks, there was a time when a group of Pittsburgh showed that if they held off on physical therapy for 6 weeks, the outcome a year later was just as good as sending someone to therapy right away. I had a local surgeon said, look, I want to send them to you because they just need some education and training. So now we're back to seeing people 2 weeks out. But it's passive range of motion to begin with, and then you'll move them on to what's called active assisted. So they may have the pulley in the other arm or lifting the arm. And then you progress to active motion where they move it on their own, and then you start light resistance and build the heavy resistance. It's interesting. The exercises really end up being the same bunch of exercises when you're moving them, when they're moving themselves, and when you start resistance.
So I think that having talked to a number of people who've been through physical therapy for rotator cuff, it's not easy. It's painful, especially at first, but it's so critical that they go to physical therapy and complete it, as you say, or else the surgery may end up not being as productive as it could have been.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yep.
Let me ask you about something called frozen shoulder we hear about. Dr. Gammons, what is a frozen shoulder?
Well, a frozen shoulder is a condition where it appears that the sort of what I would call the capsule, so the surrounding soft tissue around the ball and the socket, basically scars itself in. We don't know why it comes. We know there's some conditions such as diabetes where it's more frequently, but it sometimes comes after trauma. It sometimes has no other reason to come. It's a condition that's generally self-limiting in that it will, over time, you go through a painful phase, then you go through a freezing phase where you lose motion, and it stays painful, and then eventually the pain goes away, and then you go through a thawing phase where the shoulder motion starts to come back. That can be anywhere from probably 6 months to up to 2 years based on the person, and it's really unclear what the triggers really are for this, and we're really not even sure exactly what the best treatment is.
Well, that brings up the question, what is the surgical treatment and what would physical therapy do? What would surgical option be?
Well, most of the time, you know, the surgical option is undertaken if you're in that thawing phase for too long, so you don't have a lot of pain. You can do what's called manipulation under anesthesia, where they put you to sleep and they try to break down the scar tissue by moving the arm. There is also surgical release of the capsule, where they go in and kind of try to cut through that. It's not clear, but it seems to be that if we did that in the early phases, that it actually may end up just rescarring down so that you don't get much help from it. That way, there are some other procedures of injections and things we do, mostly probably for pain management, to be able to just kind of help people, just manage the pain while they're going through it. And I think there's some, and Mike can speak to this a little bit more, there's some controversy, I think, even within the therapy world, whether if you get to these early, whether you can keep them from freezing. But certainly there's a time frame in which the therapy doesn't seem to be super helpful because it just hurt too much. And then as the pain settles down, then therapy can often help again in terms of getting that motion back.
Mr. D, is that your experience?
Yeah, it's a great question. 36 years ago when I started this, we used to get referrals for adhesive frozen shoulders, aggressive physical therapy, and we were making them worse. And it's not proven. Now we follow the freezing, frozen, and thawing protocol. I think a careful exam, my good friends in primary care will miss this, but I don't criticize them as I'm not diagnosing more serious things. But so a very specific exam, you'll see the greatest loss of motion is in something called external rotation, and the second greatest loss is something called abduction, the arm goes up to the side, and the third one is flexion when you elevate. So if you've got that capsular pattern, you know you have it, you take the history and try to decide where are they? Are they freezing? Are they frozen or thawing? And we don't do much for them when they're freezing except give them just some education, some basic exercise to do. Some therapists think that by offering jolt mobilization, they help them a little bit more. But I'll typically explain it to the patient, give them the prognosis, and I might just have them check back with me for a little five-minute reevaluation just to take a look and see if it's thawing or the motion is changing. And if it's not, I just tell them, hang in there, keep doing these exercises, and I'll be a better benefit to you when it starts to loosen up and I can show you how to restore your strength.
Well, frozen shoulder turns out to be a lot more complicated than I thought. We have just a couple minutes before break, but we have a caller, Tom from Andover.
Yes, thank you. This isn't why I called, but I will say that I once had a frozen shoulder, went in early for physical therapy, and it was a little painful, but it did cure the frozen shoulder. But the reason I'm calling is that I played competitive tennis at both the high school and college levels on teams, and the coaches stress work, repetition, and I ended up years later having to have a shoulder replacement, which I think was caused by all of that tennis repetition. And I just wondered if there is a tendency for coaches in various sports to overwork young people and not understand that maybe that could cause some damage if there's some way of getting that word to them.
That is an excellent question. Dr. Gammons, and we may come back to this after the break, but are coaches changing their coaching styles and philosophy?
Well, there's certainly been a lot of emphasis on it in sort of the baseball world with the throwing athletes and the young throwers, limiting pitch counts. I think the same thing in tennis. I think, many, many coaches have learned that, yes, we're going to break down individuals if we're not careful and thoughtful, particularly in the youth ages when they're going through growth, which can be a big problem. I think the problem is you get to the higher levels, tennis, and when you get to the professional level, there is a certain amount of practice that you have to do to be able to compete at that level. And then there are some genetic differences in people's ability to tolerate those loads. So there's a lot of individual, what I would call load management, that goes on at those higher levels to try to keep people from having the problems that our caller had.
Shoulder replacements, in the minute we have before break, do shoulder replacements work?
They can, yeah. There's two types of, you know, there's regular replacements, and then there's something called a reverse total shoulder if your rotator cuff is not repairable. I think they both restore function in individuals. It's certainly not probably quite as robust as some of the knee and hip replacements where you can, I would say, pound them a little bit more, but people can get back to playing sports like tennis and golf and skiing and those sort of things after shoulder replacement.
Mr. D, do you have interaction with coaches and work with some of the coaches about some of these situations?
Yes, I do, and good news is it's changed for the positive. We're now starting to see our colleagues in the strength and conditioning world get in and around a lot of teams, and the coaches are letting them follow that kind of intensity of training.
That is helpful, and we will be back in 2 minutes. Stay with us. Second half of Healthcare Today, where we're looking at orthopedic and sports injuries with Dr. Matthew Gammons, orthopedist, and Michael D., physical therapist. Dr. Gammons, let's move down from the shoulder to the, I guess, the elbow. We hear about tennis elbow. What is tennis elbow?
So tennis elbow is a condition where the muscles that help you bring your wrist and your fingers up, where the tendon wears out. Basically. So again, if we go back to the rope analogy, the tendons basically start to fray as we get older, and then sometimes we can acutely overload them, like we might see people doing a bunch of spring cleanup that they weren't used to, or sometimes it gets more chronically overloaded and then they can develop pain. It's a condition that's not inflammatory. I think that's one of the things that people often get wrong. It's not an inflammation problem, it's a degeneration problem. And it does generally tend to get better, particularly if we stress the tendon in healthy ways.
Is it ever operative, or is it completely for physical therapy?
Well, it's rarely operative. When I started training, which seems like a long time ago now, there were cases we were taking to surgery, but it turns out that that should really be a rarity, and most cases will get better with appropriate therapy and time.
So, Mr. D, what is your therapy regimen for the tennis elbow, also known as lateral epicondylitis?
Typically, you want to take a look at the range of motion, and anecdotally, in my practice, I see people with a loss of a certain motion where the forearm and the palm turned down is called pronation. And we might show them some exercise and do some things to try to get a little more motion out of there. And then there's different approaches right now. There's heavy weights where you lower the palm down to the ground away from lifting it up. And then some of the older Norwegian stuff says just do a ton of light repetitions, gravity minimized, to just stimulate the collagen of the tendon. I like to add a small brace. I have no benefit from this, but I use a brace called the Band IT, B-A-N-D-I-T, and it just puts a load down on the muscles away from the elbow and dissipates the forces, and people report relief. So some simple exercises of with the elbow at 90, progressing to the elbow straight. A lot of people with the COVID, they're in and they're typing a lot more, so we're seeing that. So we'll coach them up and have them evaluate their workstation and make some changes there. But check the range of motion and give them some exercises that basically just kind of stimulate the collagen of the tendon.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned the ergonomics, which is a whole another topic, I suppose, but certainly comes into play with some of these injuries. You also keep mentioning these Norwegians and their physical therapy. What was it about the Norwegians that led them to do all this physical therapy techniques and groundbreaking work?
They really looked at the physiology of the musculoskeletal system and did a deep dive and started experimenting. It's medical exercise therapy is a generic term for it. And so it considers just in what state is the tissue pathology? Is it in an early damage and early repair? And what's the load you want to put across the muscle and tendon? Is it in more of a remodeling phase? And what's the load you want to put across the muscle and tendon? There's been some good studies, good work done on it, some anecdotal stuff, but Nancy Kerrigan, when she had her thigh contused in that awful accident, that was the form of exercise they used that really allowed her to get best tissue repair as soon as you can. You know, it's not the end-all be-all, but they did their homework, and it's really at the cellular level, what's going on with the tissue, make the decision where it's at, and apply the appropriate stimulus.
Thank you. And let's talk now about knee injuries and problems with the knees. Dr. Gammons, that's a big topic. Anywhere from knee injuries to knee strains, what are some of the knee injuries that people come to you seeking help?
Well, this time of year, at least through the winter, we tend to see lots and lots of ligament injuries, unfortunately, from skiing. So they really range from the acute injuries, where we're seeing, unfortunately, ligaments get stretched or torn, particularly the anterior cruciate ligament, often the medial collateral ligament. And then we'll, and sort of as we move into spring and people are moving outside, we'll tend to see a little bit more of those overload injuries where, as Mr. D was referring to there a little bit with the tendon stuff, is, you know, you have effectively, a tendon is very, very good at absorbing load to a point, but if we get a little aggressive as we go back out into running and doing some of our summer activities, we can overload the tendon and then create a problem similar to the lateral epicondylitis, or just along the either quadriceps tendon, which attaches at the top of the kneecap, or the patellar tendon, which attaches from the kneecap down to the shin bone.
And then there's also problems with the meniscus, right? What are meniscus, and what kind of problems do you see there?
So meniscus are two basically shock-absorbing discs that sit within the knee. They're probably best described as they really distribute load through rotation of the knee. So they're not a straight shock absorber like a shock you might see on a car, but as we twist and rotate and move, they help even out the forces. And what we will commonly see is meniscal tears. So where actually somebody has an injury where they put a tear in the meniscus, and because it doesn't really have blood supply, those tears often don't heal and can require intervention. We do, as you know, once you get over 35, and I'm well over 35 now, so it's depressing to say, but most of us will also start to get some osteoarthritis, so where the cartilage surface is starting to wear out. And at a point, once you wear out enough of the smooth surface so that wears out in arthritis, you will start to chew up the meniscus, and you get what's called a degenerative meniscal tear. Those degenerative tears haven't been shown to be helped by surgery and are really best helped by basically understanding the loads and strengthening and all the work that Mr. D does in his clinic.
Now, in terms of knee injuries, I'm sure that your physical exam can tell you a great deal, but what about how do you use radiology in assessing knee injuries?
Yeah, so the exam is really good in most cases at helping us with the ligaments, so the four big ligaments in the knee, and most of the time you're not going to need additional imaging for that. Our exam for the meniscus is okay, but not great. So if we're certainly thinking that there may be a meniscal tear and we're trying to decide whether or not it needs surgery, then we're going to think about imaging. And then, as I said, once you get over 35, we're often getting x-rays just to see what's the degree of wear in the joint. Because unfortunately, some people, even in that age range, are having some fairly significant wear. And that really changes how we approach treatment, as I alluded to, in terms of, you know, maybe you think somebody's got a meniscal tear, but if their x-ray shows a fair amount of arthritis, you're not going to really chase the meniscal tear anymore.
So which of the knee conditions absolutely require surgery, and which would you favor trying to get some physical therapy first?
Well, I mean, again, as I always tell patients, always in never being too bad words, because it's just not the way the world works. But in general, if you're a person who participates in what I would call high-risk sports, so pivoting, twisting sports, soccer, basketball, football, and you tear your anterior cruciate ligament, you're generally going to need that fixed in order to be able to go back to those sports. That's not always the case. There are people that can, you know, participate at even the professional level without that ligament, but most of us are going to need it. Other ligament injuries, particularly the medial collateral ligament, you know, aggravation of arthritis, some of those, you know, the more tendon overloads, almost none of those surgery need to be done, certainly, of course, unless your arthritis is so bad that the knee's completely worn out, and then we talk about, you know, knee replacement.
There is... When we talk about athletes, particularly younger athletes, we've seen a lot of ACL tears among young women. Can you talk about that? Are they at special risk, particularly in some of the explosive sports like soccer and basketball?
Yeah, so I mean, this literature has been around for 20, 25 years, maybe even a little longer now. There, for equal sport, there does appear to be increased rates of injury. So for high school boys soccer versus high school girls soccer, the rates of ACL injury in high school girls soccer is quite a bit greater, depending which group you're looking at. And it's not entirely clear why that is. There's been a lot of studies. It probably is both partly biomechanical, both partly having to do with some strength issues. There was some thought it could be some hormonal issues. That hasn't really panned out the way that we thought it might. And so it's still not entirely clear, but it looks like there are some modifiable factors, meaning some of the work that Mr. D would do in his clinic can help balance out some of the muscles and can, you know, not eliminate the risk of tearing the ACL, but at least decrease the risk of tearing the ACL.
Mr. D, talk about that for a minute. If you have a young high school basketball, female basketball player or soccer player come to you, and what kind of exercises would you prescribe to try and strengthen those muscles to try and avoid these ACL tears?
If they're an active athlete, most of them would be weight-bearing exercises where we really teach them to control their body and the lower extremity. We recently participated in a large study through the University of Vermont where we looked at this ACL injury prevention program out of Sweden. It's called the FIFA 11 Plus. Dr. Slaughterback was the lead investigator, and we taught those exercises to area high schools. So I'll take that program, the FIFA 11 Plus, and I'll use that in the clinic, mostly when somebody has finished the acute phase of an injury or a soreness and they're ready to start to return to sport. We can use those exercises. In the early phase, after an injury or surgery, we can use components of those exercises, but basically teach them how to land properly, and it's almost like a biofeedback neuromuscular control thing while we do basic strengthening exercises, especially of the hip and the core, the quadriceps, the hamstrings, and make sure there's good motion at the foot and ankle.
Has this information been transmitted to athletic trainers at the various high schools so that they can institute programs if they wish?
I would gather yes, and that's probably part of the education of most athletic trainers. This, like Dr. Gammon said, this information has been around for a long time. Some of the first papers came out of Cincinnati in 1999 with a program called Sports Metrics, which we learned in 2005, but now the FIFA 11 Plus is lead. So yes, I would say yes, the trainers know this.
Dr. Gammon?
Lewis, in our high school, the trainers do, and I think, you know, one of the things that I always tell coaches, because this is, you know, our ability to prevent injury is not perfect, and you can argue about, you know, FIFA 11 versus other programs, but all of those programs really function as excellent warm-ups, and they're better than the traditional warm-ups. So, you know, even at a minimum, you can convince athletes and coaches sometimes because there's a performance benefit to it, and as a bonus, you're probably getting a little bit of protection for the knee.
Yep.
Dr. Gammis, what is a trick knee?
So I think it's probably been called several things, but traditionally, I believe the trick knee sort of terminology came out of ACL injuries before we had surgical repairs, because what would happen is the knee would give out. So you would go to make a move or pivot, and the knee would kind of give out or collapse on you, and people would say, oh, that's my trick knee. Now, there's other causes of things that can sometimes cause the knee to give out, such as just pain. So if you sort of get some pain in the knee, it'll make the muscles not work, but my understanding from talking to some of the original surgeons who developed the ACL surgery is that pretty much where it came from.
What about floating meniscus? Is there such a thing?
Boy, I don't know that I've really ever heard the term floating meniscus. That terminology, there's something called a discoid meniscus, which is where the meniscus effectively takes up, instead of being like a little half moon, the meniscus essentially covers the whole surface on the top of the tibia on each side. And that, maybe that regards that, I'm not sure. But that, if you have the meniscus where it's called discoid, where it covers, it's like a circle rather than a half moon, you know, athletes are much more prone to get tears because there's just much more surface area for it to bang up against.
So we've moved from head to toe. We're down to the ankles. And we did have a podiatrist, Mary Hsu, on in December. She talked a bit about feet and ankles. But, and of course, we talked then about Achilles tears, but we might want to touch on that again because that's a serious injury. But if someone turns their ankle, Dr. Gammons, when should we be ordering x-rays?
So there's a couple of rules that have been mostly validated in the emergency room, but we tend to use them on the sidelines. But there's a common one called the Ottawa ankle rules. But effectively, if they can't bear weight on the ankle, you know, at the time of the injury or when you see them in the office, then that's an indication to get x-ray. And if they hurt in certain spots on the ankle, particularly over the two bumps on either side of the lateral malleolus and medial malleolus, those two bones, if they hurt, and then a couple places on the foot. So, but there's a large amount of ankle sprains where that typical, the foot goes underneath, where we don't really need x-rays unless their pain is not improving over a normal course, which would be somewhere over 3 to 6 weeks in most cases.
And there are ankle fractures that you might need to operate on?
There certainly are. So there's, you know, we define them as sort of stable or unstable. Unstable doesn't really mean sort of fragile or teetering. What unstable means is that you break the bone in the ankle and the ankle joint then is not lined up completely. So you've got sort of it's not fitting together well. We want to straighten that out with surgery so that the ankle surface is as even as possible, because that decreases the risk of arthritis later.
Mr. D, Achilles tendons, we don't want to tear an Achilles tendon. Dr. Gammons, are you still there?
I am.
Okay, I think we lost Mr. D, and he had told me he was going to have to leave.
Okay.
Let's talk about Achilles tendon.
Yep.
How do we prevent Achilles tendon tears? Because that's a devastating injury that, as we heard from Dr. Hsu, can take months to recover from. How do we prevent Achilles tendon tears? How do we prevent hamstring tears?
So let's start with the hamstring just because there's a little better evidence. So there are some studies that show that if we do what's called eccentric loading through the hamstring, an eccentric exercise would be one in which the muscle is lengthening while it's under tension. So imagine if you wanted to hold, if you held a weight in your hand and instead of curl it up towards your shoulder, you start from the shoulder and slowly lower it, that's kind of stretching the bicep as you do that. But if there are programs that look at eccentric exercises that actually decrease the risk of getting hamstring strains. So in athletes that do, you know, explosive type sports, that seems to be very effective. We don't have that same information for the Achilles. We do know we can make the Achilles tendon stronger by doing a similar type exercise where we're loading through the tendon while it's lengthening. But there haven't really been studies to show whether or not that decreases the risk of rupture.
What are warning signs for an Achilles that the weekend warrior we hear about? What are warning signs that the Achilles might be at risk of tearing?
Well, that's the one problem, is that most people who tear their Achilles never get a warning sign.
Mm.
They just go out and play. They're in a basketball game or they're in a tennis match and they go to push off and the Achilles just lets go. So I think, you know, again, common sense would be, look, if you're doing explosive sports, as particularly as we get older, and older from a tendon standpoint is really over 30, that doing some of those exercises that help strengthen the tendon and certainly making sure that we get warmed up well before the activity, are both ways that we could possibly decrease the risk. But that is the issue, because again, most of the people that we see with tears really never had a prodromal symptom. They wasn't sore, didn't hurt them, it just went.
Well, and orthopedists and podiatrists, I guess, either can operate on Achilles tendons. Let me ask you finally, about the World Cup skiing. I assume, since you're based up in Killington, or partially based up in Killington, that you've been involved over the last several years when the World Cup, Women's World Cup, came in.
Yes, yeah, so I'm the medical director for the event, and then the staff.
Tell us what. Can you tell us a little bit about what that was like, and any interesting moments that you remember?
Well, I will tell you, it is interesting. It's, you know, organizing a whole race. So Dr. Boynton and I had spent many years and our predecessors many years just traveling with the team. So we'd go show up at a race, and we would be just responsible for the U.S. team. You know, kids, we're not responsible for the whole race or everybody. But when the race came to Killington, they asked us if we would take over that. And it is a lot of planning. It's a lot goes into a lot of meetings. You know, because it's so weather dependent, there's a lot of factors that go into not only, you know, is the race going to go off? What time is the race going to go off? What's interesting about skiing compared to some other sports is the sort of what they call the FIS, the Federation, International Federation of Skiing. They actually dictate over top of me where I can put my staff, where people can be. And so you really have to communicate a lot about, you know, with the people that are organizing the actual race side versus the medical side. The other thing that's kind of scary is, and for those of us that ski, Superstar obviously is the trail at Killington where we've had that race. they inject water into the snow many times, trying to get it as hard as possible, which makes it a really great race surface, but it makes it very scary for the rest of us to try to get down. And I consider myself a relatively accomplished skier, but there's been many times when I was up there where I was more concerned about my health getting down the hill than I necessarily was the racers.
That yes, that would be a challenge. Are these United States team, I mean, are they always in pain? I can't imagine if going through a season at that level that they're not all nursing some injury or another.
I would say yes, to some degree, you know, particularly once they get going into the season. You know, most of it, hopefully, you know, most of it is minor and manageable and soreness. Some of it can be pretty, you know, pretty hard. And skiers, unfortunately, are very prone to getting back pain. And sometimes that can be a real problem for them because they can just put such high loads into the snow. And there's something probably that has to do with sort of, when, you know, when you, if you're familiar with skiing, that there's a lot of vibration that comes up through the ski. And that seems to fatigue out the muscles in the core, and that may load the back more. And they really struggle to the point where we even had a few kids this, you know, this winter's been different, but a few just came back from Europe because their back hurt so much they couldn't ski.
That, you know, I don't follow skiing closely, but I had not associated the back pain and back injuries as much as I would with knees and shoulders, head injuries. But that's very interesting to know. You'll continue that, I assume, working with the skiers.
Yeah, that's the plan. Hopefully, we're hoping to have the World Cup back again next year, and then you know, we'll continue to Dr. Boyne and I, and now Dr. Carl, who's one of our other specialists, also a ski team doc. So we'll continue to travel to different places to help support those athletes and their goals.
Well, I hope so too, because it's a wonderful event for Rutland and for all of Vermont, particularly when Mikkelis Schifrin comes and wins.
Absolutely.
So I want to thank Dr. Gammons, who's still with us, and Michael D., who had to leave earlier. I think what one of the take-home lessons is that with orthopedic injuries, it's very much a team approach, that surgeons do what they do so well, but also without the physical therapists, either before or after surgeries, we would not have the results we have. So it's totally a team effort. And I want to thank both of our guests today. I want to also tell you a little bit about our show next week. We have we're going to focus on medical care of the transgender patient, which is certainly an issue here in Vermont and across the country. And our guest will be Dr. Rachel Inker of the Community Health Center in Burlington, who is one of the, not only one of the top experts for Vermont, but one of the top experts in the country. So I hope you'll join us then. I definitely want to thank Dr. Gammons. Thank you again for your time and participation. And we wish you all the best.
Thank you.
So we will see you next week. In the meantime, be kind to yourselves, be kind to others. Thank you.
Today with Dr. Lewis Myers, brought to you in part by Age Well Vermont, the leading experts and advocates for older adults in northwestern Vermont, Westview Meadows and the Gary Residence, retirement living the way it's meant to be, Kinney Drugs and KinneyDrugs.com, employee-owned and locally committed, Northfield Pharmacy, pharmacy care with a personalized hometown touch, NorthfieldPharmacy.com.
The music for this program was written and produced by Armin Bayajian.